oral history to Howard, Ron, and Selma Weiss, and it's May 12th, 1995. We're interviewing Dr. Lade Kessler.
I'm Dr. Lade Kessler, 6516 Beacon Street. Howard had a waiting.
It's on.
They're both together.
All right. Howard asked me to talk a little bit more about the demise of the Hebrew Institute. Let me just say that I got into the Hebrew Institute in 1965, 66, somewhere in that time. I'd say 75, and became president of the Hebrew Institute about 1980 or 81. But at any rate, the Hebrew Institute was a legendary institution in Pittsburgh. It had many strong supporters. It had started out as an Orthodox organization in the early part of this century. It was organized really by Rabbi Maurice Abrams, who was considered to be a major leader and was revered. And at that time, there were a lot of immigrants, youngsters coming to this country who needed to go to a school. Obviously, there were no established Jewish schools. It was not the practice in those days for synagogues to have Jewish schools. The Jewish synagogues were limited and were limited only to places for praying and not for teaching. So that there was absolute necessity, and that necessity resulted in a school which at one time had 1,000 after-school students, in other words, after regular grade school students who would come to learn Hebrew. As the congregations then started to develop schools of their own, based mainly on their need to attract membership, developed rather limited capacity schools, some good, some fair, and some bad. The Orthodox community went their way. The Reformed community didn't teach at all. And there was a middle community of conservatives, mainly, who developed their own schools, so that there became a less and less requirement for an institution to teach Hebrew and history to after-school students. Then the movement started sometime in the, in the 50s, toward day school, full day school activity. And it was these various movements that took students away from the Hebrew Institute. By the time that I became president of the Hebrew Institute, we were down to maybe 70 or 80 students per year, and this included kindergarten as well as regular classes. It was very hard to maintain any interest because most people belonged to synagogues, and for the same money that they got their member for their membership, they also got their kids educated. Parents tended to lose interest in the educational process. I know because I was one of them. And so that it was very hard to get money for this. The United Jewish Federation did support education to a large extent. Then we ran into certain conflicts. One of the major conflicts was that if you're going to teach a child through his early years how to read Hebrew, how to pray, and what the customs are, there comes a point when he's 13 years old where he has to be bar mitzvah, and it seemed illogical then to turn him over to somebody else, like a synagogue to which his parents may or may not belong, and say, you have to bar mitzvah this child. Well, it was the attitude of the board of the Hebrew Institute. Therefore, he should be bar mitzvahed right on the premises by the very teachers who taught him. When this became more and more of a problem, the synagogues rebelled against the Hebrew Institute, and it became a community fight that existed and ended up in conflict at the level of the Jewish Federation, who was supplying money. The Jewish Federation position was, correctly so, that we had to have, and I took this position as a leader of the Hebrew Institute, that we had to have a central, non-affiliated body that provided for a person who couldn't either afford or did not want to belong to the synagogue, that their children could still learn about Judaism without having to be subjected to any particular rabbi or any particular synagogue, if that was their choice. However, there weren't enough of those people to satisfy the needs of supporting a major institution. However, the Hebrew Institute had one thing going for it that was unusual. It had a large alumni who were very loyal, and it had a property, the only significant, major, worthwhile property owned by the Jewish community, in this case the Hebrew Institute. So that said, as the old story about bottom line goes, that said tons of votes on behalf of the Hebrew Institute in any negotiations we had for budgets over the years. However, gradually, the support wore away because the students were fewer and fewer. For example, it was people were figuring out on the budget committee that we were then getting $250,000 or more from the Jewish community, from the Federation, to support the Hebrew Institute. The rest was money coming from the tuition fees and from small drives and largesse of individual alumni and friends of the board and so forth. And the budget was somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe $500,000 a year. But there were some inequities. One inequity was that in 1953, we decided that there should be a school for advanced Jewish studies. At that time, it was the idea that the School for Advanced Jewish Studies should be part of the Hebrew Institute, since it too would be supported by the United Jewish Federation. However, they decided that at that time it was probably a good idea to make the school separate. Why? Because the man who was brought to Pittsburgh, wonderful scholar, by the way, whose name happened to be Dr. Kessler, not this Dr. Kessler, but Dr. Aaron Kessler, came here in 1953, and he wanted his own show. And he did not want to be part of the Hebrew Institute, then run by a deity, literally, in this community, Rabbi Morris Abrams. Wasn't that his name, Maurice?
Israel
Abrams, that's right. I was wrong. Israel Abrams. And his son Saul was then was one of the teachers and principal of the institution. But he did not want to become part of that, realizing that he would lose his personal autonomy. And he was a major figure. There was no question about it. It would be two major conflicting personalities between Israel Abrams and Aaron Kessler. So the School for Advanced Jewish Studies became an independent operation. So that the Federation was saddled up after the ensuing two decades with the problem of supporting two major institutions. But the School for Advanced Jewish Studies never had its own property. So they had a rent space, and oftentimes was rented from places like Carnegie Mellon Institute, Carnegie Institute of Technology at that time. It became obvious that there were certain inequities because there was no reason for them to have to go out and pay for the space in the community when there was space at the Hebrew Institute. We tried to convince the Federation Board and Planning Fathers that the proper place was a combination of the two institutions in one with two separate heads, but it was not possible to bring this off as long as Saul Abrams remained as head of the Hebrew Institute and Aaron Kessler remained as head of the School for Advanced Jewish Studies. We formed many committees and had many meetings and tried.
Boards are basically incompatible.
So then, well, we didn't have on here about CDS, so I have to go back to that. So then, another complicating factor was that through the auspices of Saul Abrams and other leaders of the Hebrew Institute, a group wanted to develop a day school, and there were people on the board of the Hebrew Institute that felt that that was a good idea. So they helped to underwrite the concept of a day school with a group of people. Stop that. The Hebrew Institute offered its premises to this group to form a day school. And it did form, it is functioning today, it is quite successful, but we had a period of climbing, of difficulty, getting on track. We had a competition from the Hillel and the Achim Tanim, and there was a lot of hostility because they were using the premises of the Hebrew Institute, which essentially was a United Jewish Federation agency, and yet they were not getting money from the United Jewish Federation. So there was this element of hostility to the Hebrew Institute. I think I mentioned about the element of hostility from the synagogues because of the bar mitzvah issue. There was the element of the personality clash between the heads of the School for Advanced Jewish Studies and the Hebrew Institute. And faced with this, a declining number of available students because of the declining Jewish population in Pittsburgh. And it was rather a precipitous decline, as a matter of fact. I then got the idea that maybe we could save the Hebrew Institute if we were able to pool together some of the outlying districts. And I call it the outreach program. And we did fairly successfully, but there was a certain problem. The question was busing versus sending teachers. Well, if the Hebrew Institute then was going to be in the business of just developing teachers to send out to Mount Lebanon, to North Hills, to Beaver Falls, to Elwood City, then we didn't need to maintain a large structure and a building and a major administrative expense to do that. What we need was a teacher training program. A teacher training program was therefore underwritten, however, a lot of the hostility on the board because of these various divisions refused to give that to the Hebrew Institute, realizing, I guess, subconsciously that was one way to save the Hebrew Institute. So there were so many disparate elements that when I then left the presidency and others took over...
Were you the guy when Dr. Bronner was brought in?
Yeah. We then finally, and in the midst of all this, I should say that there was an element in the community, and particularly on the board of the Federation, was to get Saul Abrams out of the picture. Because, I don't know why it was, there were certain elements who were friends of mine, by the way, who felt that he was not a good administrator. He was a man who was teaching our children with love and kindness and interest. He was also administrating, he was also the principal, he was also the janitor. I mean, this is a man who did everything, particularly as we got into leaner and leaner years. He supervised whether the furnaces were on, whether the walk was shoveled. I mean, the transportation, he would be out there on cold mornings getting the kids on buses. And yet, there were elements in the community that refused to recognize the importance and the value of such a man as this. Nonetheless, I'm just portraying some of the issues that became actually hot issues in the period of the 1980s. I then lost interest, fell out, because Brunner, I was disturbed because I had planned this outreach program. And with it, I had planned a capital fund development so the Hebrew Institute could establish some independence. I then found out that when we brought in Dr. Brunner, a wonderful teacher, but a horrible administrator, he began to use this money that I had socked away for capital development just to pay day-to-day expenses. And he said, what am I going to do? I have to pay the expenses. I said, send the bills to the Federation. That's what you do. You don't use that money. At any rate, we had also had a camp that was left to us in a will, and we put the value of that camp at probably $750,000, and it was my plan to eventually sell this camp and use that money to build up this capital fund. and also to rent space to the Jewish community for the School for Advanced Jewish Studies would provide more money. These plans, however, were shot down every time I turned around by people who were out to get the Hebrew Institute as it stood and out to get Saul Abrams. It became almost personal vendettas. Some of those people, I realize in retrospect, though they didn't appear so on the front, were really behind it all, supporters of the Orthodox community, though they themselves were not Orthodox, because their children had become Orthodox. Some of my best friends, as the saying goes. And I realized that that's why we were fighting. The Orthodox community that didn't think the Hebrew Institute was qualified to teach the students, the conservative community that considered it a competition in taking students away from their after-day schools that provided a reason for people to join, and as the ranks of Jews in the community began to decline, the competition and the heat generated more hostility. So that when Bart Cowan became president of the Hebrew Institute, he succumbed to an agreement that they would combine all the schools in one under a totally new administration and totally new board, and the old board was forced into a position where we had to agree to turn over the Hebrew Institute building to the new institution called the Jewish Educational Institute. It's had some growing pains. This happened in 1992. This is 1995. It's had some growing pains. We've had some problems. I don't want to go into all those. Some of them is lack of maturity of the people who are on the board, lack of the leadership maturity. They made the grave mistake of forming a new board. It's interesting. They took over the property from the old board, yet had very few people from the old board to be even represented on the new board. For instance, I was not asked, as a past president, not asked to be on the new board.
Neither was I.
Howard Braun, sitting here, was also on our board.
But for 25 years.
But I'm talking about past presidents. Elliot Finkel was not asked to be on. I mean, yeah. Elliot Finkel had been president longer than any one of us prior to my term. Harvey Walsh was not asked if he had been a past president. So it was very interesting that they made up their mind that they wanted to get rid of the whole thing. And this was done at the Federation level.
Who was on the board now? Who were some of the people on the board?
Mostly parents of active students, some doctors, a few doctors. The point is, they're nice people, but they don't have good leadership. They came to me about two years ago. What's his name? Come on, help me out. The current head of the Institute, Jewish Educational Institute, called me. In 1993, I guess it was 1994, I lost track, and said, I'd like to talk to you. Came here, I invited them for brunch, and he and another person came and they talked me into coming on the board, claiming that they had a lot of problems and so forth. Would I come back on the board? I said I would. So I accepted an appointment to the board. I went to one meeting, and I was so appalled when I went to that meeting, I never went back. What was I appalled about? I was appalled because it was a group of parents who had no concept of management from the overall point of view. They're only interested in a specific little problem of that day and not total planning. In other words, they were dealing, and this is the way the Hebrew Institute once was run and why I think it eventually deteriorated before I came there. That parents were quarreling about whether you should teach chapter Gimel or chapter Alpha, not about the long-term concepts.
Maybe that's why they asked you to come back on the board.
They did, but I was not, I was 70 years old, I was not about to get in there and start all over again what I had done at the Hebrew Institute 20 years earlier and get into a battle with these irate parents who, I can tell you, there's nothing worse on a board of directors than a parent who thinks they know everything about teaching. One of my concepts and one of the problems I've had all my life is dealing with boards of directors who think they know more than the professionals who are running the organization. I've always ended up being the defender of the professional because I am a professional. And I know that nobody knows anything about what I do more than I know about it. And it's very hard for me to accept boards of directors for hospitals and boards of directors for symphony institutions and boards of directors for educational institutions because I know that unless they're a very mature and experienced group, they just are not going to be easy to deal with. And my attitude being that there's a role for boards of directors, and that role is to organize, to raise money or give money, and more of the latter, which does not happen, and hire the right people to run the institution. And if the institution is doing well, leave them alone. Not doing well, get rid of them, but don't try to tell them how to run an institution. So this I was not willing to do again. But that essentially is the history. They're pretty successful, nonetheless. The day school, I understand, has 265 students this year. The man I've met to, who's the executive director, Skip Greenberg, and Skip just was here this week giving me a report because we were talking about another matter about some funds for, raising funds for the, for some scholarships for busing because some of the parents can't afford to pay for the buses. So he came to talk to me about that, and Skip told me that the School for Advanced Jewish Studies has, I think they have 180 students. So it is successful. Their budget is $650,000 from the Federation, but the budget is actually much bigger than it was in the days when I was there, and that's understandable. But it was a good move. The thing, the only difference was that it could have been done under better circumstances without eliminating all the old people and starting over again, I think, but maybe I'm wrong. Next subject. Any questions about that? Howard, you're knowledgeable on that subject.
No, I'm very happy. You not only covered it well, but you expounded some aspects of board philosophy, what should be board philosophy, generally applicable across community work, which I had not heard expressed as you did just before, which I thought it was terrific.
Thank you. Well, at any rate, that's so much for the Hebrew Institute, and I'll bring up to date some of my personal community activities as they reflect on the community. I think I did talk about the organization, the physicians division, my development of Maimonides Society in Pittsburgh, which has become very successful. I have since been asked, and this was now a year, last fall, to be the chairman of the Maimonides Midwestern Executive Committee. There are now 20 Maimonides Society in the UJA Midwestern Division. The UJA is divided in this country into three, naturally, the East, the Midwest, and the West. The Midwest takes from Pittsburgh west to Tulsa, Oklahoma. It includes Chicago and St. Louis and Kansas City and New Orleans, et cetera, et cetera. And I have organized an executive committee consisting of 15 doctors from the major cities of that area. We had our first meeting by telephone this past week, and we are now planning an annual meeting to try to get together and stimulate the growth of Maimonides societies. And why are we doing this? We're doing it because we realize that a larger and larger percentage of the active affluent Jewish community are professionals, both lawyers and doctors. There was a time when that would have been the case, but young men couldn't get into medical school if they were Jewish. So now they can get into medical school and make up about a third of the medical student bodies. The lawyers, I don't have to mention, have expanded exponentially. There are now, for instance, in Allegheny County, 7,500 lawyers, for example. We have more lawyers in Allegheny County than any other single county in the country. I just learned this figure yesterday from Elliot Finkel.
That's right.
That's right. So, that's right. That's what Elliot
told me. A lot of them can't get jobs either.
We had a meeting yesterday at the UJF and this subject came up. And Elliot told me that figure. Getting back to the history, and therefore it's obvious that as young people in our society, young Jewish people, are becoming more diverse in their interests in professional life, coming from well-to-do established Jewish families, which was not the case in 1930 or 40 or 50. But now most young people come from a well-established business family, and they don't want to go in their father's business to a large extent. They want to be professionals, and their families want them to be professionals, and they're going into a number of other, they can get into engineering, Howard, for example, which you know they couldn't have 30, 40, 50 years ago. So, in other words, we don't have that central source of funds and communal activity that was fostered, supported by the business community by and large. Pittsburgh is the best example whatsoever. We have a large, affluent Jewish community that now lives half the year in Palm Beach and does not want to stay in Pittsburgh. Their children are not coming to Pittsburgh. So we have to utilize, in many communities like this, the potential sources of funding and energy, and they are, to a large extent, among the professionals. One of the problems that the Jewish doctor has always been criticized for is that he's not interested in Jewish activities. I've defended that publicly on the basis that Jewish doctors are, by and large, pretty much like the average population. If they come from a philanthropically minded family, they will be philanthropic. But it's harder for a Jewish doctor to be as generous as a business counterpart for the reason that a business counterpart can afford to get sick. His business will go on. He can even afford to die. His wife or his children can go in and run the business. For a doctor, he gets sick, he's finished. That's it. He dies, the wife cannot take over his business. His son can't walk in and take over. So that he has to not only pay for his education, he's got to pay for the future, he's got to protect himself with insurance. And the worst aspect of all of being a doctor from a financial point of view is he pays tax on every dollar that comes into his house.
And there's a lot less dollars coming in this generation.
That's right. Well, that's another issue. But the point is that the doctor has never been in the economic position, by and large. He makes good living, makes a sure living. He makes a very affluent living. But he's criticized because he buys an expensive automobile. He buys an expensive automobile because that's tax deductible. Otherwise, he'd be paying those tax dollars out. Many reasons like this that people don't understand. However, this is what we're left with. We have in Pittsburgh somewhere between 800 or 900 or 1,000 people who claim to be Jewish who are doctors. I mean, that compares with a time when I went to medical school when maybe there was 100 Jewish doctors. So that we have to utilize this strength, and that's the basis of trying to interest people in not only fundraising, but activity within the Jewish community, and therein lies the basis of trying to organize Maimonides societies around the country, which I'm now heavily engaged in that. I was honored in 1993, they gave me an award for this, and I just mentioned that out of hand. I say they, the local Maimonides societies which I organize. I must say they're all very generous. When I go to a meeting, they always make note of the fact that I was the moving force in getting the local Maimonides society started, so they're very kind about that. I want to talk next about the subject of the Jewish family and child, as it once was called, now called, the Jewish Family Assistance Fund. In 1985, a man by the name of Herman Lipsitz, did I talk about this?
Yeah.
I did. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I talked about, great, all right. This, I just bring you up to date. I was asked to be the president. I don't think I told you that. So I'm going to take over the presidency of this organization in June, president of the board. It was my idea that we should not do it as a separate entity, a separate organization, but should do it in cooperation with the organized Jewish community. And therefore, just yesterday, I had a meeting with representatives of the UJF, and we're going to try to work out a cooperative plan. It's my concept that we have the Jewish Children and Family Service, which does similar work, though not the same, and does extension work in the same field. In other words, we'll give a person who is sick and can't go to work this week money to pay the rent. But what if the person is sick for a year? We are not geared for that, and they need additional help. They may need a nursemaid in the home, that sort of thing. The Jewish Children and Family Service can go beyond what we can do. So we realize, we met with them yesterday, we met with the Federation yesterday, that there is room here for working this out together. We have a great philanthropist involved, and that's Herman and Helen Lipsitz, and they're willing to put up large sums of money, but we're going to have to raise additional sums of money as well. And June of this year, I think June the 18th, we're having our annual luncheon, and we're going to try to raise some money at that, and also have a guest speaker. And we're going to try to develop this organization into an established part of the Jewish community. Well, this organization is important because, believe it or not, there are poor Jews. No matter how many...